Since 1947, the World Affairs Council has become the preeminent global stage for world leaders and the public to inform, engage, and debate the most important issues of our time. It's your world. Get to know it.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. Tonight we resume the George P. Schultz Lecture Series, and our speaker tonight is General David Petraeus, Commander, U.S. Central Command. The event is sponsored by the Marines Memorial Association and by the World Affairs Council of Northern California. The Marines Memorial Association is a nonprofit veterans organization organized and chartered to honor the memory of and commemorate the valor of members of the United States Armed Forces who are killed or died in service for their country. We provide in this building a living memorial with the facilities for forums and meetings such as this, with educational lectures to promote the literary interest of our members. And I invite you to take a few moments after our program this evening to visit our tribute memorial wall on floor 10M, where we honor by name, rank, and service all the Americans we've lost in the current wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Membership in the Marines Memorial is open to all U.S. military and to Americans currently serving in the U.S. Armed Forces. You can learn more about our association at our website, marineclub.com. For those who may not be familiar with the World Affairs Council, the Council was established in 1947 to engage the public in the exploration of issues and opportunities that transcend borders. To learn more about the organization's diverse programs, please visit their website at itsyourworld.org or review the flyers that are out in the lobby. The Council programs can be heard each Monday night on a program on NPR called It's Your World, which this program tonight will be taped to be aired later on. Tonight's program is being recorded for broadcast on radio, and we thank our audio engineer, Ms. Jane Heaven. Our sequence of events for the program tonight shows that we will bring on the colors, sing our national anthem led by Rochelle Perry, accompanied by Robert Rudd at the piano. After the color guard leaves the stage, Rochelle will sing America the Beautiful. Then we'll start the official program for broadcasting. It's now time to bring on the colors. I ask, ladies and gentlemen, if you would please stand and remain standing and sing along with Rochelle in singing the national anthem. Color Guard, march on the colors. Ladies and gentlemen, take your seats, please. The color guard is provided by the 23rd Marine Regiment here in San Bruno, and I think they're really sharp. Big hand for the color guard. Thank you. Rochelle Perry will now sing America the Beautiful. Rochelle?
Oh, beautiful for spacious skies, for amber waves of grain, for purple mountains, majesties above the fruited plains. America, America, God shed his grace on thee and crown thy good with brotherhood from sea to shining sea. Oh, beautiful for patriot dreams that cease beyond the years, thine alabaster cities gleam undimmed by human tears. America, America, God shed his grace on thee.
Thank you, Rachel and Robert. That was truly wonderful. Ladies and gentlemen, my name's Joe Hoare. I'm a retired Marine. I'm also chairman of the board of directors of the Marine Memorial Association. We're now ready to start the program. Let me call your attention to the question cards that have been placed in your programs. Please write the questions that you have for General Petraeus on those cards. Pass them out to the aisle. They'll be delivered to me. I'll be over here in the corner. I'll sort them, try and get them together, and then I will ask the questions to General Petraeus. Finally, before we begin, since this show is going to be taped, I would ask your indulgence to shut off your cell phones and your PDAs if you haven't done already. I think we can now begin taping the program. Tonight is a continuation of our George P. Schultz lecture series held here at the Marines Memorial Club in downtown San Francisco. Secretary Schultz will introduce our speaker, General Petraeus, tonight. It's my job, in fact, to introduce Secretary Schultz. Before I do that, though, I want to thank him publicly for lending his name to this lecture series. To have such a distinguished public servant sponsor this lecture series has elevated the Marines Memorial Association's reputation to a new level. It has also helped our partnership with World Affairs Council. Again, Secretary Schultz, we thank you very much. For those of you who are unfamiliar with the biography of the former Secretary of State, I refer you to the program where we've attempted to condense his spectacular career into a few sentences. I would point out that he held four different cabinet posts in our government, including Secretary of Labor, Director of the Office of Management and Budget, Secretary of the Treasury, and Secretary of State. As Secretary of State for 8 years, he played a key role in implementing the foreign policy that led to the end of the Cold War. He was awarded the Medal of Freedom in 1989, in recognition of his achievements. He has held teaching positions in three of the country's greatest universities, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, the University of Chicago Graduate School of Business, and at Stanford. He was the dean at the Graduate School of Business at the University of Chicago. Subsequently, for 8 years, he was president of the Bechtel Group, a major engineering and construction company headquartered here in San Francisco. Secretary Schultz is a graduate of Princeton University and holds a PhD in industrial economics. After graduating from college, he joined the Marine Corps and served in combat in the Pacific Theater during World War II. And when he left the Marine Corps, he was serving in the rank of major. His service to our country and his following success in the private sector represents, I think, an astonishing achievement. It's a high honor and a great pleasure for me to introduce to you our host for the evening, the Honorable George B. Schultz.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We have a real treat in store for us this evening, and the standing room only crowd shows that that's widely appreciated, and also that you know a lot about our speaker. But let me give you a few additional points that you may or may not be aware of. He graduated from West Point, and he was a distinguished cadet, which means he was in the top 5% of his class. He was an avid soccer, skier, participant in all the West Point activities, as I understand it. However, there is very convincing evidence that he did not spend all his time worrying about the academic life and the athletics and so on. And the evidence is that only 2 months after he graduated from West Point, he married the daughter of the superintendent of the West Point. Pretty good work. So he graduated as an infantryman. He went to Ranger School, did fantastic. Before long, he's airborne. Next thing you know, he's mechanized, so he's seen the Army, you might say, from the ground, from the air, and through a tank, all the aspects. And he has risen through the ranks, held a variety of command positions, staff positions along the way. So he learned how it all works, and he learned about responsibility and how to exercise it. He learned how to analyze things, how to create a strategy. Of course, we came to know him very well in America in his work in Iraq. First, in the initial period in Iraq, he did a brilliant job, and he learned something from that experience. Then he came back, as we all know and very well publicized, to lead what was called the surge, and the whole situation turned around, and we have a much better picture of what took place. I don't know about you, I watched the hearings when he testified, and it was very reassuring and very made you very proud to be an American and to have that kind of leadership that he showed. And now, of course, he has command of the whole Central Command, which covers Afghanistan, Pakistan, as well as the Middle East and the Levant. Just one more thing about learning. It's obvious that he likes to learn, and he's good at it. General Hoar mentioned that I went to Princeton. So did he. He went to Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School, and all I could get out of it was a bachelor's degree, but he got a Master of Public Administration and a PhD out of it. So he's a learner. He made a few observations after his tour in Iraq, and I'm just going to read them in conclusion because it shows you kind of basic way that he thinks. Here are his observations. Do not do too much with your own hands. Money is ammunition. Increasing the number of stakeholders is critical to success. Success in a counterinsurgency requires more than just military operations. Ultimate success depends on local leaders. There is no substitute for flexible and adaptable leaders. And finally, a leader's most important task is to set the right tone. Well, General Petraeus, you've been setting the right tone for a long while. We admire what you've done, we thank you what you've done and are doing, and we look forward eagerly for your comments. General Petraeus.
Well, thank you very much for that, Mr. Secretary. Good evening to all of you, and thanks for that very warm welcome. Mr. Secretary, thanks for the very kind words and the kind introduction and for lending your considerable personal prestige to this lecture series. More importantly, though, thanks for all that you've done during decades of service to our country, for leadership at the highest levels of our government, and service in the Marine Corps from private to major in World War II. It is, of course, a particular privilege to follow a fellow Princetonian, especially one who has done so much to live up to the unofficial motto of that university, which is that holds that Princeton in the nation's service. And now adds, and in the service of the nations. Thanks for dredging up that little research tidbit about dating the soup's daughter. It wasn't easy to keep that. That was my first clandestine operation. If you want to get some ribbing, you know, you just date the soup's daughter at West Point. But I do want you to know my wife and I just celebrated our 35th wedding anniversary, so I think we might make it. And I can tell you it was certainly the best decision that I ever made. In fact, my wife was Mrs. Dad. She's been Mrs. Dad for 5 of the last 7.5 years, and the reason we have 2 great kids is a heck of a lot more to do with her than with me. Well, I should admit that your introduction is the kind that could tempt a man to feel a little bit important. Were that temptation to strike, however, I'd simply remember the response of a young soldier at Fort Stewart, Georgia, when, as we were waiting for the chairman of the Joint Chiefs to arrive, I asked the soldier, "Well, son, ever seen the chairman of the Joint Chiefs before?" "No, sir," the soldier said after a pause, "not that I recall." So I'll do my best tonight to make this a reasonably memorable event, but I offer no guarantees. But it is a real pleasure to be here to speak to the Marine Memorial Association, an organization which does indeed do such tremendous work in honoring and serving America's service members and veterans, and to address members of the World Affairs Council of San Francisco, another organization that plays an important role for our country in fostering dialogue on important international relations issues. And I want to thank each of those organizations. And note that this being the third time I've spoken to a World Affairs Council this year, I hope I can get all the requisite punches on my loyalty card to get the World Affairs Council t-shirt. Now, earlier it was noted the service that the Marine Association in particular plays in helping our soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, Coast Guardsmen, and their families. And I would like to ask that all those who have served or are serving in our armed forces stand so that we can indeed thank you for your service. Again, thanks to each of you. Thanks to your families who have sacrificed a great deal as well. Thanks to the Leathernecks of the 23rd Marines who served as our color guard this evening. And thanks to Rochelle for an absolutely beautiful rendition of our Star Spangled Banner and also of America the Beautiful. General Hoar, we appreciate your kind words earlier and for your steady hand at the helm of Central Command during your time there. I know that you are here this evening in part to grade my work and to report to the other former Central Command commanders. All I would add is that, one reason that we still have all these challenges in the CENTCOM region is that perhaps not all of them were solved on your watch or those who followed you. The truth is, he could probably give this briefing for me tonight. I can't say that I minded the prospect of a trip to the West Coast and to the Bay Area in particular as we sat in Tampa or on a plane flying around the region for which we're responsible. And in fact, as we were preparing for the trip here, I asked my aide what we might do today that would give us a real taste of San Francisco. And they came back with some great research and a whole list of activities, quite a menu, a yoga class, an aromatherapy class, a conversational Mandarin class, or a building your own website seminar. I thanked him for those great suggestions, and we ended up going for a great run this morning instead. And I must say that it was refreshing to have cool air and some hills to take on after 8 months of the Middle East and Tampa, Florida heat and flat terrain. In light of the four-star representation, though, from almost all of our services here today, I thought that perhaps I'd start out with a particularly relevant joke. An Army general, a Marine general, and an Air Force general were stranded on a desert island. No, I'm not going to do that one to you, don't worry. Actually, I do want to pass on an interesting story I heard this afternoon on the way over here. Apparently, a couple of former service members, a Marine gunnery sergeant and an Army staff sergeant, were headed into town late yesterday to be here for this lecture. The way I heard it, the Marine was driving in from the north and the soldier was driving up from the south. As chance would have it, on a road right in downtown San Francisco in the middle of the night with no other cars on the road, they ran right into each other and both cars went flying off in different directions. After assessing his situation, the gunny managed to climb out of his car. As he surveyed the damage and looked at the wreckage, he said to himself, "Man, I am really lucky to be alive and in one piece." Meanwhile, the Army sergeant crawled out of his car and stared in utter shock at what was left of it. "I can't believe I survived this," he said. Awash in the moment, the sergeant walked over to the gunny and said, "Hey man, I think this is a sign from the Almighty that we should put away our petty service differences and rivalries and live as friends instead of as rivals." The gunny looked at him, thought for a moment, and responded, "You know, you're absolutely right. We should be friends. Hey, let's see what else survived this wreck." So the gunny pried open his trunk, rummaged around, and pulled out an unopened bottle of Jack Daniel's finest whiskey. Eyes wide, he turned to the sergeant and said, "I think this is another sign from God, one that tells us that we should toast to our newfound understanding and friendship." "You're darn right," the sergeant replied, and he grabbed the bottle and took a long drink from it. After putting away nearly a third of the bottle, in fact, the sergeant handed it back to the gunny and said, "Your turn, devil dog." The gunny took the bottle, twisted the cap back on, looked at the sergeant and said, "Nah, I think I'll wait until after the cops show up." Can't put anything past those gunnies. Well, thanks for laughing. You know the old deal. I'm only as good as the material they give me. I might add, in fact, this was provided by the same speechwriter who gave me a joke that featured Microsoft in Seattle last night. And my PowerPoint quickly went on the fritz. Well, hoping that Microsoft is no longer cross with us. What I want to do tonight is, in fact, use a little PowerPoint, discuss the Central Command area of responsibility, describe the challenges in it, focus in particular on Iraq and Afghanistan, a few other items, and then take your questions. And with that, if I could have the next slide, please. This slide shows the Central Command area of responsibility, some 20 countries from Egypt in the west to Pakistan in the east, Kazakhstan in the north, Yemen in the south, but also down and including the waters off Somalia, which of course gives us the counter-piracy mission and the missions to help counter weapons smuggling as well. This also shows how we focus our efforts in a region that has over 550 million people, that has some of the richest countries in the world, some of the highest per capita incomes, and also some of the poorest countries and some of the lowest per capita incomes. It has countries that are extraordinarily blessed with oil and gas, and many that have very little water. Numerous ethno-sectarian groupings, major languages, and a host of challenges. And the way we go at those challenges in many cases is by working on work and partnership building, as we are in the stands, where we are seeking to establish a broad partnership, including with Russia, if we can put the new great game behind us, to focus on working together against extremism and the illegal narcotics industry. Certainly working to help our Pakistani partners, who over the course of the last 2 months have taken relatively heartening steps in combating a threat that they now see as one that threatens their very existence. And for the first time, certainly in many years, the people, the political leadership, and the clerics all support the actions by their military against the Taliban and SWAT in Northwest Frontier Province, and also against elements in the federally administered tribal areas. We are working hard, of course, in Afghanistan, and I'll talk a good bit more about that. We are working to counter various activities of Iran, both in terms of its nuclear ambitions and its continued assistance to Shia extremists in Iraq, in southern Lebanon, in Gaza, and also then to the Taliban in western Afghanistan. In part because of provocative Iranian activities, we find enormous interest in partnerships in the Gulf states and the west side of the Gulf, and I'll talk a bit about some of those. We are also, of course, continuing the effort in Iraq, and I'll explain that in a moment. We have considerable effort with Lebanon, which recently had elections that, again, the results of which were quite heartening. Working hard, as always, with Egypt, and working in Yemen, where al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula appears to have established its new headquarters, having been significantly reduced and roundly defeated in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the other Gulf states, and also been reduced substantially in Iraq and even in the federally administered tribal areas. This is an area through which much of the world's natural resource, energy sources flow, and so ensuring trade routes and flow of maritime activity is very important and another of our missions, and we also are active in the effort to counter piracy. Next slide. These are the challenges then. As I will show, the situation in Afghanistan has deteriorated significantly over the course of the past 2 years. And that is one that we must arrest, a downward spiral we must arrest and then reverse, and to continue to help Pakistan to carry out the very aggressive activities that it has launched over the course of the last 2 months. I'll show the progress in Iraq, but also talk about the considerable challenges that still remain there. As we reduce our forces, we, needless to say, want to work very closely with our Iraqi partners to sustain the gains that we fought so hard together to achieve. I mentioned the Iranian influence, which in many respects is malign in character and is destabilizing to its neighbors, as it does indeed arm Shia extremist elements still, and also, of course, the enormous concerns in the Gulf area about Iran's apparent desire and activities to gain a nuclear weapons capability and delivery means. I noted the efforts to bolster Lebanon, to assist Yemen, and to partner with the Central Asian states, all of which are important. The piracy, illegal narcotics effort, and countering arms smuggling, in particular that which goes, again, to Hamas in Gaza. And then we're working very hard to support initiatives launched by President Obama and the new administration, which are led by superb senior envoys. In the case of the Middle East peace process, it's former Senator George Mitchell, who, of course, was so instrumental in bringing peace to Northern Ireland. In the case of the approach to Afghanistan and Pakistan, I'm privileged to have one of the world's consummate diplomats, Ambassador Richard Holbrooke, who, of course, was the lead figure in the Dayton Accords. And, you know, it's every soldier's dream to have an ambassador as his partner who has the nickname Bulldozer. And he has earned it, and he is brilliant, and he has extraordinary energy and focus. And a reason that there has been progress in certain respects is in no small measure due to his leadership in his initiative. And then Ambassador Dennis Ross, another very experienced diplomat brought back out of retirement to focus on this very important issue of Iran, and also the effort to reach out to Syria, some opportunities for which present themselves now that are being taken advantage of by the Arab world, by Egypt and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia in particular, and also have included visits by our Assistant Secretary of State, Jeff Feltman of Near East Asia Bureau, and then various of our European partners. Next slide. Iraq. There has been very substantial progress in Iraq, but there are innumerable challenges. We are now in a significant period of transition. Our non-American, non-U.S. coalition members are in the process of completing their departure. The last is now moving out, although the NATO training mission in Iraq appears that it will stay. We are reducing our forces slowly but surely over time. We just completed the withdrawal of combat elements and bases from the cities, something, frankly, we've been doing for about 18 months, but certainly carried out a number of significant actions in recent months as we approach the 30 June deadline in the security agreement between the United States and Iraq that was negotiated by the Bush administration. And, of course, we're changing our focus as we do that from us conducting operations to us supporting Iraqi forces who are conducting operations. They are indeed assuming those tasks. They are significantly larger than they were in the past, over 550,000 members of the Iraqi security forces, significantly more capable, but still certainly need to develop and need a variety of the so-called enablers in particular, some of which we will continue to provide for them in the forms of close air support, attack helicopters if required, various intelligence assets and platforms, and a variety of other forms of assistance. They conducted the elections in January of this past year. Those outcomes were heartening as well, because the parties most associated with Iran and the more religious parties lost out to those that were more Iraqi nationalist and more secular. And the new provincial governments have now been seated, and they are much more representative of the populations in the Sunni Arab predominant provinces in particular, given that the Sunnis boycotted the elections back in January 2005. But a lot of challenges ahead. There's a census that could be emotional because of various issues involving Sunni, Shia, Kurd, Turkmen, Yazidi, you name it, and then the run-up to the January 2010 elections. There certainly are still al-Qaeda and other Sunni extremist elements, and tragically we have seen them carry out horrific, sensational attacks in recent weeks and even some in fact, today. And there are also still active Shia extremist elements as well, although their activity is dramatically reduced from what it was prior to their defeat in the spring of 2008. There are, as I mentioned, still outside influences that are decidedly unhelpful. Iranian activity in many respects is described that way accurately. Syria has taken some actions that, together with other actions that we have taken with source countries and inside Iraq in taking down the networks that facilitate foreign fighters, They have reduced the flow of foreign fighters through Syria into Iraq from about 120 per month to probably somewhere between 10 and 15 or so per month, and that is very important because some of those are suicide bombers. There are still certainly many elements of mistrust between Sunni and Shia, between Arab and Kurd, internal to Shia, internal to Sunni, and so forth, and those will continue to exist for some time, although the fabric of a society that was torn apart during the ethno-sectarian violence prior to the surge has perhaps had a stitch or two put back into it as the security has improved, but I don't want to overstate that at all. Iraq has gone from a situation in which it had $140 per barrel oil that was buoying its economy back now to somewhere in the low $60 per barrel and is having to learn to live within its means in that regard. There are still areas in which it needs to improve basic services, many areas, although I should note to their credit that not only have they rebuilt all of the electrical and oil infrastructure that was damaged so heavily by the insurgents, they have indeed broken the electrical production records now many times this year and just did it again last week. But having said that, it is still probably somewhere between 50 and 70% of what they actually need. And then there are a number of other challenges. There are provincial boundary disputes that have to be resolved, and the significant dispute between the Kurdish regional government and the rest of Iraq as to where the boundary of the Kurdish region will be. And that, of course, also revolves around the status of the oil-rich city of Kirkuk. Next slide. This shows the progress, though. This shows security incidents from 2004 to just last Friday night. And what it shows is that after the Samar Mosque bombing in early 2006, that the violence took off in a very, very horrific manner. And, of course, it was that which led to the surge and also to the employment of forces in a different manner than we did before, and I'll talk about that in a moment. But ultimately, we reached a number of incidents in a particular week that was nearly 1,600. What this was about 160 attacks, because there's more than just attacks on here. It's attempted attacks as well. But there were 160 attacks per day on average in the most violent week of June of 2007. And more recently, for the past 6 months, as you can see, it's been up and down, but it's generally been between 10 and 15 attacks per day during that period. In the month of June, despite high-profile attacks that cause us concern, was the lowest level of security incidents on record since we started keeping records in July of 2003. Next slide. High-profile attacks do cause us continued concern, although the total, and that's what this top line represents, of car bombs and suicide vests, has been reduced dramatically since the height in the spring of 2007 during the surge of offensives. Nonetheless, there are still some 20 or so per month, and those can cause horrific damage, particularly now that some of the security checkpoints have been removed, some of the barriers and all the rest of that that was a feature of the landscape because of the security needs, but have now been dismantled at the request of the citizens who have seen much lower levels of violence and who obviously don't want to have traffic jams, constant vehicle searches, and all the rest. But that has meant that some of these bombers have been able to get through in a way that they were not in the past. Next slide. Now, to go after al-Qaeda or to go after the Shia extremists, although this slide talks about the strategy that we used to go after al-Qaeda and its Sunni extremist allies, to do that requires a very comprehensive approach. And we originally used this slide, some of you will recall, in our testimony to Congress when Ambassador Crocker and I did that on Capitol Hill in 2007-2008. And the point we were trying to make was that you have to use all assets at your disposal, that doing in al-Qaeda in Iraq and its Sunni extremist allies requires more than just counter-terrorist forces. Indeed, it requires more than just military force alone. And we added, of course, additional 30,000 forces. The Iraqis added 125,000 during the course of the surge, and we hired another 100,000 so-called Sons of Iraq that were a function of the tribal awakenings that rejected al-Qaeda and the other Sunni extremist organizations. But it takes much, much more than just kinetic, just military operations. It takes political activities, ultimately laws and policies. It took those tribal awakening. It took other initiatives that could reduce these ethno-sectarian pressures that had caused the cycle of violence to escalate as it had. It takes better use of intelligence. And although we have had very important breakthroughs in various intelligence disciplines, from imagery and signals intelligence to measurement and human intelligence, the real breakthrough has been in the fusion of all of the products of those disciplines and then of the development of applications in the info technology world that have enabled us to layer that in cyberspace, if you will, and draw out conclusions. But we put together all of the intelligence agencies and forces in fusion cells in each of our divisions, didn't allow walls in those centers, and required everybody to share everything with each other, and it worked. We also had the benefit of vastly increased numbers of intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance platforms, unmanned aerial vehicles among them, and that also helped enormously. We had to completely overhaul how we did detainee operations so that we identified the worst of the worst and didn't allow them to turn these detainee locations, we had 26,000 of them at one time, into terrorist universities, which is what happens if you don't identify the hardcore and separate them from the rest of the population and then rehabilitate the rest. We're now down to below 11,000. We'll be below 10,000 here fairly soon, and the recidivism rate has been considerably lowered by the programs that we've instituted. It also, of course, takes so-called non-kinetics. It takes addressing the root causes of why individuals might be attracted to plant an improvised explosive device, join an extremist organization, or what have you in the first place. So you've got to get at jobs, you've got to get improved services, work on education, religious engagement, and all the rest of that. And then you have to do a great deal of work in the strategic communications arena. You have to be active in the internet. We'll talk later about how we focused on always being first with the truth. And you have to work outside the country with source countries. We worked indirectly with Syria and so forth. All of that designed to put pressure on every aspect of al-Qaeda's needs, to take away some of their weapons caches, to reduce the flow of foreign fighters, to take away their sanctuaries and safe havens, to reduce their popular support, to discredit their ideology, disrupt their command and control, take away the money that is the oxygen of these movements, and disrupt the linkages that they had to the al-Qaeda senior leaders in the federally administered tribal areas. Next slide. Now, as we did the surge, there were a number of big ideas that guided our employment of the additional forces. Keep in mind, again, it was not just 30,000 extra forces. More importantly, it was how those forces were employed. And it started with a complete focus on securing and serving the population. It was not just about killing or capturing bad guys. You have to do that, certainly. But far more important is a focus on securing the people and serving them. And you can only do that by living with them. We literally moved into their neighborhoods, and we moved into the worst neighborhoods first. We ultimately created 77 additional locations in Baghdad alone and dozens of others in the areas outside Baghdad in which our troopers, together with our Iraqi partners, lived and helped secure the people and over time gained their confidence, got better intelligence, and enabled the revival of local markets, schools, hospitals, and so forth. Next slide. We took that comprehensive approach that I just described. You cannot do it strictly through military means. In fact, we banged away in Ramadi with our high-end counterterrorist forces for years, and yet you still couldn't drive from one side of Ramadi to the center of town without getting hit. It wasn't until we committed the forces and actually had a plan to hold and build, as well as clear, that we were able to accomplish the tasks that we set out for ourselves in terms of securing the people. Next. We also had to achieve unity of effort. Again, this isn't just about military alone, as you saw. It's also about all the elements of our government, of other coalition partners, and of our Iraqi partners' governmental elements. In this respect, Ambassador Crocker and I worked very hard to link arms and to take this forward together. We developed a joint civil-military campaign plan. Our offices were located next to each other. We always went to see Prime Minister Maliki together. And we also briefed all congressional delegations together. Next slide. Especially briefed congressional delegations together. Now, don't get me wrong. This is not all about nation building. It's not just about the stability and support ops. It is also still very much about offense and defense and about going after the enemy relentlessly, getting your teeth into Al-Qaeda or its Sunni extremist allies or the Shia militia and extremists and not letting go until you have killed, captured, or run them out of there in the event that you weren't able to reconcile with some of their elements beforehand. Next. As I mentioned, you don't want to start clearing until you know how you're going to hold, and then you have to hang on to them. And a number of occasions in the past, we cleared and left, and predictably the enemy came back. Next. We had to promote reconciliation, and to do that, you had to identify who were the irreconcilables and separate them from those who could be made part of the solution instead of a continuing part of the problem, in other words, the reconcilables. We worked very hard at this. We created a special element that did nothing but this, led by a British two-star and a senior U.S. diplomat, created an intelligence organization that supported it so that our troopers could truly figure out in a very granular and nuanced way the situation at local levels, because that is indeed where you do indeed promote reconciliation. Next. As we transitioned security tasks to our Iraqi partners, we ensured that those were conditions that they could handle. If we can't handle a situation, there's no way that we could hand it off to them, and so we sought to make those transitions conditions-based. Next. We had a very aggressive information operations campaign and a very aggressive public affairs effort. But the guiding principle in this was this one here, being first with the truth. We didn't spin. We didn't put lipstick on pigs. We had a time when, in fact, at the period of the surge, where an old mentor of mine came out with yet another study group, and he pulled me aside, put his arm around me, and said, "You know, Dave, you've got a message problem out here." And I said, "With all due respect, sir, we don't have a message problem. We have a results problem. And when the results get better, then people will see it. The press will recognize it. I'm confident, and we'll talk about it. But until then, we are not going to do anything other than to report exactly what is on the ground, and it's not pretty." Next. We also were very, very emphatic about the need to live our values. There are a lot of reasons, for expedient reasons, why you might want to cast those aside in the short term, but I can tell you that every time that happens, that one pays for it in the long term. And there was a period where I got concerned, based on the results of a survey, at some of the really toughest fighting, that some of our troopers might be willing to turn a blind eye to some activities. And we, in fact, published a directive about the importance of protecting and living the values that we have fought to preserve for generations in our country and needed to do the same when we were in other countries. Next slide. We sought very hard to set a tone, to use that term that Secretary Shultz talked about earlier, in which young leaders felt that they could indeed and should and were encouraged to exercise initiative. This is small unit activity. It's a small unit leader's war, if you will, counterinsurgency. And so what we sought at my level was to get big ideas, to try to get them right, certainly, to communicate them to the leaders and then to oversee their application. But at the heart of that, you need young leaders, lieutenants, the strategic captains, as we sometimes call them, sergeants, battalion commanders, and so forth, who would turn big ideas into operational reality on the ground based on their very nuanced appreciation of local situations. And we wanted them to be out there and to get on with it. And I sense that we probably were doing that reasonably well when I was in a patrol in a particularly tough area of southwest Baghdad that had turned around, in fact, and I saw a sign on the company commander's plywood door that said, "In the absence of orders or guidance, figure out what they should have been and execute aggressively." I would have promoted him on the spot had I had the authority. What I did do is tear down that sign and take it back to the headquarters. And put it on my own wall, and then actually added it to our counterinsurgency guidance. And finally, the importance of constantly seeking to learn, to adapt, to make changes, because this is a learning enemy. It's an adaptable enemy. And what works today in an area will not work tomorrow. What works today in one area won't work today in another area. And so you must constantly be attuned to the situation and adjust what you're doing in accordance with your observations. Next. Now, let me talk a bit about Afghanistan. And I put up here the longest campaign because when I was coming home from a second tour in Iraq, on the way home, Secretary Rumsfeld asked me to come home through Afghanistan and to do an assessment of the train and equip effort there, the effort to stand up the Afghan National Security Forces, because I'd just spent 15 and a half months doing that in Iraq in a second tour there. And so we did, and we went out there. And obviously, you do a bit of compare and contrast of the two countries, and needless to say, there is a PowerPoint slide that came out of that that said Afghanistan does not equal Iraq. And there were enormous differences one to the other. In fact, the challenges were so substantial that I offered to him that I thought that this would be the longest campaign in what was then called the Long War. The fact is that it will take sustained, substantial commitment to make progress in Iraq, indeed to arrest a spiral downward in the security situation and then to turn it back up. It's going to take the extra forces that we are deploying. Of course, we're going from about 30 or 31,000 at the beginning of the year to 68,000 by the end of the year, adding vastly more enablers, helicopters, logistics forces, intelligence platforms, and the rest, substantially augmenting our trainers and advisors, and on the civilian side, the embassy side, adding hundreds of additional civilians as well, all of which are very important. We have a very good new team on the ground. General Stan McChrystal, the commander of ISAF and U.S. Forces Afghanistan, and Ambassador Carl Eikenberry in the U.S. Embassy, who have forged a great partnership, are already working on a joint civil-military campaign plan, and General McChrystal's in the midst of a 60-day assessment that he'll be bringing back to us in about another month or so. Clearly, there has to be a substantial effort to help the Afghan National Army and police, and part of the assessment is a determination of whether they need to grow to a number larger than is currently envisioned, which is likely the case. The effort does indeed have to include Pakistan, one reason that Ambassador Holbrooke is responsible for both countries and indeed for surrounding areas as well, and that this president's strategy was indeed for Afghanistan and Pakistan. And of course, as I mentioned earlier, we have to strive to achieve unity of effort, in this case, not just between U.S. forces and the U.S. embassy, but between the NATO forces and all of the embassies, international organizations, NGOs, UN assistance mission, and of course, our Afghan partners in the various ministries and executive branch. A number of activities that have to take place. We have to reverse the cycle of violence. We, again, have to focus on securing and serving the population. The way we live with this population will be different. You don't move into the little villages. That's not culturally acceptable, nor is there any room at the inn, if you will. There are no empty houses in any of those villages. So you live near it. You still do have to have a persistent security presence, however. Over time, the effort to promote reintegration, as it is termed, in Afghanistan will have to include the identification and the separation from the population of the irreconcilables. We're working hard to ensure an election on 20 August that will be seen as legitimate by all the members of the Afghan population to help the Afghans build government that gets their allegiance rather than is seen perhaps as predatory or corrupt. To work on the illegal narcotics industry, which is a plague on the southern part of the country in particular, but on the entire country when it comes to trying to implement the rule of law in general, and then to work on these other issues down here as well, including the rule of law, combating corruption, supporting development of their economy, and working to assist local communities. Next slide. Over time, we want to get these security incidents driven down, and I just want to show you this because it shows you indeed how serious the security situation has escalated. Over the past 2 years in particular, you can see, and now into 2009, the fighting season this year, you can see the substantial increase in security incidents in Afghanistan. And again, this slide shows once again from 2004 to this past week. And what it does also show is very much how the fighting is seasonal there in a way that was never quite the case in Iraq. Next slide. This shows where the violence is. And, of course, that is where we have to focus and, indeed, where we are focusing. But you can see here in Helmand Province, which is, by the way, the home to the biggest of the poppy crops. Kandahar province, a traditional Taliban stronghold, basically the Pashtun belt, as it's called, and then in regional command east, out here coast, Paktika, and so forth. And as it notes here, 70% of the violence is in 10% of the districts. Next slide. This slide shows where our additional forces are going, and I should note there are also additional NATO forces that are going in, between 5 and 10,000 for election security, as we also bring additional Afghan forces into the mix as well. But our first additional major element, an infantry brigade combat team, went into the Wardak and Logar province areas just southwest of Kabul. A combat aviation brigade went into the regional command south area. That more than that, with together with the Marine Air Wing, more than doubled the number of helicopters on the ground. The very large Marine Expeditionary Brigade, and you can be very proud of the operations they're carrying out now in Helmand Province, many of which have been in the news in central and south Helmand, along the Fishhook, as it's called, the river along which the population lives. The next element deploying in now, Stryker Brigade Combat Team. Stryker vehicle, as I'm sure you know, is served with considerable distinction, as have the units built around it in Iraq, and we're keen to get them on the ground in Afghanistan as well, and they will operate in Kandahar and in the surrounding areas. And then something very important, we're going to take an airborne brigade combat team from the great 82nd Airborne Division with additional leaders provided to it, and they will then overlay on the Afghan National Police and the Afghan National Army in the southern provinces of Regional Command South, and we think that that will help, again, considerably. Next slide. Before closing, I want to talk very briefly about how we fight nowadays, because occasionally folks say, gosh, all the military does now is this nation building or civilian support operations. And I can tell you that the commander, for example, of the 3rd Brigade, 4th Infantry Division in Iraq back in the spring of 2008, during the Battle of Sadr City, would take some offense at those kinds of characterizations. Indeed, this was a case in which one brigade commander was provided more intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance assets than any commander has had in our history. Just to put it in perspective, when I was the commander of the great 101st Airborne Division at the start of all of this, and we did the fight to Baghdad, the entire corps, Army Corps, of several divisions had one predator and not a very good downlink, and of course we all fought over it like cats and dogs. Now you have one single brigade commander who, for this battle against rocket teams and mortars that were being launched in volleys of significant numbers out of Sadr City, a neighborhood of some 2 million people, as a counteroffensive when Prime Minister Maliki ordered the Iraqi offensive supported by our troops into the southern city of Basra against the Shia militia, this is what we arrayed to support that brigade commander. Two Predators full-time with full-motion video and Hellfire missiles on them, full-time close air support from the Air Force, three Apache teams of two each, 24 hours a day, two special platforms, one from special mission units and another from an intelligence agency, every other platform imaginable up to U-2s and so-called national technical means, six other unmanned aerial vehicles, Shadows and Ravens, aerostats with optics, towers with optics, radars that ring the city so that we could find out precisely where rockets or mortars were launched from and then vector the full motion video over to that. And once we built the pipes, if you will, the command and control architecture, because this takes enormous bandwidth to push all the full motion video down, have a screen for each one of these platforms with, of course, a chat room underneath it, and that's how we command and control them, believe it or not, because the pilots for the Predators might be at Nellis Air Force Base in Las Vegas, believe it or not. The intelligence analysts might be in Fort Meade, Maryland, or in Georgia, or in Europe, and then others, of course, watching it are in various places in the country of Iraq. Over time, this constellation, this array of assets, enabled us with relatively limited collateral damage, other than an area along which we had to fight to establish a wall, to destroy 77 rocket teams in the course of about 3 or 4 weeks and to take out one of the top eight leaders, wound another, and take out the special assistance of another. This is still about fighting. This is still what we do, although I would argue that the abilities of our troopers and our leaders to conduct many, many other missions, so-called full-spectrum operations that come with the stability and support operations that are a component of full-spectrum operations in addition to offense and defense, make them very special individuals indeed. Next. At the end of the day, it's about these folks right here. And I've been privileged to serve with them for 4 years in Iraq and a year before that in Bosnia since 2001. This occasion was July 4th last year in Baghdad, where I was privileged to reenlist 1,215 of those great soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines. Now, I want you to think about this, if you could. This is in combat. They are raising their right hand, swearing an oath of enlistment. That means that they very likely will return to combat again for yet another tour. And many of them have had two and even three full-year tours, had already had them at this time. We have asked an extraordinary amount of them and an extraordinary amount of their families, and they have done magnificent work for our country and for the community of nations. Again, I can imagine no greater privilege than being able to soldier with them as I have in recent years. And with that, I want to thank you very much.
General David, I guess my mic isn't working. Okay. I'm going to moderate the next portion of this, and yes, you're right, it's a marked requirement. Good job. A lot of questions from our audience, some really super ones, but in the interest of time, I'm going to try and group some of them together. One of the frequently asked questions is, what is the end state that we expect to see in Iraq? What do we hope will be the way in which we can walk away?
Yeah. Well, I think we are seeing the outlines of it, frankly. We are seeing a country that is governing itself, that is largely securing itself, and that is taking care of the affairs of its people itself. Certainly, there's still an enormous amount of assistance. Obviously, we still have 130,000 or so troops on the ground, and there is considerable work to be done, and there are innumerable challenges that still face that country. But you do have, if you will, Iraqocracy, which is the Iraqi form of democracy. There is representation. There is forced compromise between the different political blocs, the different ethno-sectarian groupings. It has to happen by the nature of their political structure, the Constitution, and the way their Council of Representatives interacts with the Executive Branch and the Presidency Council. Presidency Council alone, for example, has a Kurd as the president, a Sunni vice president, and a Shia vice president. They all have to approve legislation. So again, you see the outlines, I think, of what it is that we hope can be achieved there, and certainly it would not be a country that would allow transnational extremists to base themselves in it, and ideally it would be a contributing member, not just of the region, but to the global economy as well.
Another question that had been touched on several times, both in Afghanistan and Iraq, was the belief in the paucity of State Department, AID, USIA people that would complement our military efforts. Could you comment on how we're doing on that? Are we doing better in the past, and how much more do we need to do?
Well, I think we're doing a bit better, but I think we need to do much better. In fact, I have been one of the biggest champions for the State Department's budget and for AID's budget on Capitol Hill, along with Secretary Gates, I might add. And the reason is that obviously we want our civilian partners, and our civilian partners want to have the assets that are necessary to complement and contribute to what it is that our soldiers are trying to do. If we can achieve a foundation of security, the way you reinforce it and build on it and then improve security further is indeed by complementing it with actions that are typically associated with those who work for AID, who work for state, who work for some of our other departments and agencies in the U.S. government or other international organizations. The fact is that that budget is still much too small. I think that someone has calculated that there are more band members in the active and reserve components of the U.S. military than there are foreign service officers in the State Department, although I'd ask that you confirm that before you use that fact.
Can you talk a little bit about security of the nuclear program in Pakistan? That question was asked in several different ways.
Well, you know, and President Obama and others have answered that as well and essentially said that our assessment is that that security is adequate, that there has been assistance to it over the years in various ways. It is certainly a topic that we discuss when we were there. I was recently, about 2 weeks ago, there and talked to General Kiani about it and was reassured. There is a professional force, a professional element that is in charge of securing it. But needless to say, it is something that has to be, you know, this is one of those tasks where perfect is good enough. And it has to be perfect given what it is that we're dealing with here. Not we, actually, it is they. If I could mention, by the way, when it comes to Pakistan, again, the big difference over the past 2 months is that they are fighting their war against what they see as an existential threat to them, not fighting our war. And indeed, they are so determined to do that and to do it themselves that in some cases they have actually turned down offers of assistance that would be a more of a direct combat role, if you will, or more directly related, certainly not our troops on the ground or anything like that. And this is because, again, they have to fight this for themselves, and that is a very significant change that has taken place over the course of the last 2 months.
Would you comment on the use of predators, armed and being used against Taliban and Al-Qaeda in Pakistan and Afghanistan, and whether that's a policy we want to stay with?
I'm sorry, but I would not comment on it with respect to the federally administered tribal areas because, in fact, we don't. There are observers. Actually, the former director of the CIA did, in a little remarked speech back in November, December of last year, note that the leadership of Al-Qaeda and other allied elements in the Fatah had been significantly damaged by explosions that took place there. But beyond that, that's about the level of any comment that I have ever seen on that, and so we defer that. With respect to the use of unmanned aerial vehicles in Afghanistan, we are, in fact, as part of the augmentation of our forces, also significantly increasing the intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance assets, such as those unmanned aerial vehicles, and they are of enormous value. Yes, it's a so-to-straw view of the world, and you have to keep that in mind. They are not all seen. It is not quite like a Tom Cruise movie where you have a big screen in Washington and folks watch it and push buttons or say, take the shot. It is much more complex, much more difficult, certainly, than that. And by the way, it's not done there. It's done downrange. But having said that, the value of that is enormous. And again, it is what has enabled us to conduct operations like the one I described in Sadr City, as opposed to, say, the kind of operation we had to conduct in Fallujah in November 2004, where we had to do enormous damage to the city to clear it because we did not have anywhere near the density of assets that could do what they did by the spring of 2008.
Can you comment on where we are with respect to eradication of poppies in Afghanistan, particularly whether destruction as it was done in Turkey a number of years ago or substituting crops, how do we get an optimum mix in order to help the farmers and eradicate the poppies?
Well, I think the optimum mix is to have very little eradication and a great deal of crop substitution, support for agriculture, alternative agriculture, and so forth, and then touch wood that you can have wheat prices go up as they have relative to poppy prices or relative to the prices of poppy products. The fact is we think that the poppy production this year will again be down in Afghanistan, but that is in part due to market forces because of having so much on the market from previous years. It's also from the price of wheat going up, and it is indeed in part because of some of the efforts against this illegal narcotics nexus, if you will, between them and the insurgency. But one of Ambassador Holbrooke's important contributions very early in this effort was to convince everyone rightly that eradication should be reduced very substantially, if not eliminated, as a tool in our arsenal, because that just takes it takes out the little guy. What you're doing is you're taking away the farmer's livelihood rather than going after the big guy after the farmer's already have been paid off, which is, in fact, what we are emphasizing now. And we've conducted a number of significant operations in Helmand Province in particular against these larger drug kingpins that provide money to the insurgency as well.
Could you talk a little bit about the training of police forces in both Afghanistan and in Iraq?
First of all, as a general proposition, training the police is the most difficult when you are conducting train and equip missions. And the reason is that individual police are the most vulnerable in an insurgency. They are not units. They're not at a base. They're not deployed far from home. They are actually living in their home village or town or city. Everyone knows who they are. Everyone knows where they live, and everyone knows who their family is. And they know where the kids go to school. And so they are very susceptible to intimidation, to kidnapping, to murder. And they are the first to crumble when you have a situation of an evolving insurgency in an area. So you need actually to support them with units. Either in Iraq, they were national police units, and obviously the Army, and then some high-end SWAT and Special Operations Force elements. But we literally had to reclaim large elements of the Iraqi security forces from being in the grip of the militia, having been hijacked by the militia. And indeed, the national police themselves, which were units and presumably could have stood up to this, to reclaim them, we, with our Iraqi partners, had to replace their national commander, both of their division commanders, every one of their brigade commanders, and 70% of their battalion commanders. This is serious stuff. By the way, certain ministries had been hijacked in Iraq as well. One of the early tasks that Prime Minister Maliki asked of me, I was literally only there for 3 weeks in one of our early meetings, he turned to me and said, "General, by the way, could you arrest our Deputy Minister of Health?" This is still in the getting to know you phase. I said, "By all means." I mean, yeah. I said, "Are you joking?" And he said, "Yeah, while you're at it, arrest the Brigadier General who's in charge of the Ministry of Health Security Forces, too." And I knew what we were into at that point in time. We also had to detain the head of the Sky Marshals and most of the Sky Marshals at Baghdad International Airport, which had been hijacked by militia elements as well. With respect to Afghanistan, clearly the police have been the element that has been the most challenging, again, for all the reasons I just mentioned. They are very susceptible, very quick to be intimidated in these tough areas. And as the violence has escalated, they have often either been killed, run off, or again hijacked because they are trying to survive. And that gives you some sense of the challenges when you're trying to carry out these security assistance efforts.
In Afghanistan, can you talk a little bit about the competence of the Afghan forces and the progress on training up enough troops so that we have them in the field to work with the Army and Marines?
First of all, there are some units that have quite good reputations, deservedly. The Afghan commandos, their special operations forces. There is an element of the Afghan police that has done quite well. Again, units, though, not individuals. The Afghan National Army has done relatively well, a mix in some respects, but boy, they will fight. And then the police are the ones, of course, who have proved most challenging for all the reasons that I just mentioned. A big question right now is how large should those forces be? And I think that even a back-of-the-envelope bit of math tells you that they need to be a good bit larger than the number that for which they were originally programmed, although there's a big tension here because you have to make sure it is sustainable for a country whose overall revenue generation is probably still less than $1 billion a year. So if you expand these forces too significantly and too rapidly, you have to figure out what you're going to do in the long run. On the other hand, as some of us have observed at various times, if you don't get the short run right, you won't have to worry about the long run. And indeed, we have emphasized that. And so part of General McChrystal's assessment will be to come back in with a recommendation on how large the Afghan National Army and police should indeed be.
Several of the people in the audience wanted to know how you got, how you chose General McChrystal as your man in Afghanistan.
Well, first of all, you know what? Well, you well know, having been a CENTCOM commander, that it's not the CENTCOM commander that picks a position as important as that. But having said that, he was certainly my recommendation without any qualification and out here next to anybody else. First of all, we served together for decades. We were literally running partners. He is a phenomenal runner. In fact, I noted when someone asked Les Gelba, the New York Times, formerly the New York Times, I guess, you know, how would you describe Stan McChrystal, because he knew him in the Council on Foreign Relations, he said, well, my answer is zero body fat. And that's an accurate description. But this is an individual I served with him for some 4 or 5 years in Iraq and in the Balkans when he was the commander of the Joint Special Operations Command, the longest commander ever of that organization by far. He took it enormous distances. These are our highest end forces. You know all the names of them. And they are the ones who really are the tip of the spear when it comes to our effort to counter extremism in terms of the kinetic operations. And I worked very, very closely with him there. He also replaced me twice, once in the 82nd Airborne Division, once in the 18th Airborne Corps, and we've worked very closely since he joined the joint staff there in the Pentagon as well. He is the perfect pick for the job. He had absolutely the confidence of the chairman and the secretary as well, needless to say. And again, we're watching with considerable admiration as he charts the new course there. He has already published, for example, a tactical directive, which gets at the heart of this whole issue of civilian casualties. It's a very difficult, very emotional, very challenging issue. But the fact is that we cannot achieve overall success if we win a tactical fight but undermine our strategic goals by the way that we use close air support in particular in killing civilians in such an event. And so we don't want our soldiers going into a fight with one hand tied behind their back, certainly, but we do have to have them very keenly aware that in some cases you literally may be better off backing away from a particular tactical engagement so that you preserve your strategic objectives.
Can you comment on the program in Saudi Arabia to retrain, reorient former al-Qaeda fighters that is ongoing?
It's actually a very impressive program. And in fact, Saudi Arabia has, by and large, defeated al-Qaeda in its country and helped its neighbors to make progress as well. We should remember that 4.5 years ago, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia was challenged significantly by al-Qaeda. Our consulate in Jeddah, the summer capital, if you will, for the kingdom, was overrun by al-Qaeda. Literally, some of our employees killed there. The Ministry of Interior headquarters in Riyadh was blown up. Oil workers were attacked. Foreign workers were leaving the oil fields, and it was a very, very dicey and dire situation. New leaders were put in place, in particular in the Ministry of Interior. They employed the same kind of comprehensive approach that I discussed earlier today, not just kinetic operations, but a whole-of-government approach, and including, by the way, reforming their detainee operations in the same way that we did, as we learned when we later compared notes with them. And what they've done has been quite impressive indeed. And as I mentioned, they've also helped some of their partners, their neighbors in the region. But now they need to help Yemen, and they're trying to do that.
We have only a few moments left, but we have some questions from the media people. One has to do with Iran, and more specifically, the possibility of placing perhaps Patriot batteries in Poland and in Europe? And what are the appropriate ways militarily that we should be responding to the possibility of a nuclear threat from Iran?
Well, if I could, I'm not really qualified to talk about what we might be doing in Europe. Again, there are some challenges in the world that actually aren't in the Central Command area of responsibility, and those in North Korea are among them. But with respect to the Central Command region, certainly, as I mentioned, it has been almost astonishing to see how the Gulf states have sought to partner with us in a way that is unique, I think, since actually before General Hoar's time as a Central Command commander, probably since the end of the Gulf War. There are substantially increased numbers of our Patriot batteries that are up and radiating in countries there. There are initiatives in the shared early warning arena. You don't have that slide handy very quickly that shows the initiatives, do you? If we might be able to pull this up. But there are a whole host of efforts that we have ongoing, all listed right here, air and missile defense. Again, shared early warning, common air picture. This ties into efforts to protect critical infrastructure more effectively, a lot more cooperation in maritime security, the whole effort to interdict arms smuggling. There is the creation of regional training centers such as the Air Warfare Center in Al Dhafra in the United Arab Emirates, the King Abdullah Special Operations Training Center outside Amman, Jordan, and a whole host of others, including a variety of counterproliferation activities. The fact is that Iran's provocative actions, true, real actions, and provocative rhetoric have caused enormous concern in this part of the world, and the result has been much more active partnership with us and with the other countries in the region.
One more question. After we achieve our results in Iraq, how persistent are those results going to be? This is another question from the media.
Well, clearly it will depend on the activities, obviously, of Iraqi political leaders and of the Iraqi security forces, and also how the government is able to gain the support of the people. The fact is, frankly, that there is a fairly high degree of support for the government of Iraq, and that manifested itself in Prime Minister Maliki's parties in particular, and in the parties associated with his movement, winning in the January elections of this year, the provincial elections. And that's a reflection of their approval of the progress made most specifically in the security arena. But of course, over time, that certainly will not be enough. Understandably, they will want the additional progress in the areas of basic services. They want to continue to have the representation that is manifested in the Council of Representatives, and they'll want, again, continued service of them in terms of improving health, education, water, and all the other services that a country expects from its government. If all of that can be done, and I think it can be, indeed, with all kinds of emotion and to-ing and fro-ing, to be sure, then Iraq can move forward, and the new Iraq, the new land of the two rivers, can indeed be a success, and one that all of us who have served there will be proud to have say that we helped to contribute to it. And with that, again, thank you very much, sir.
Thank you very much.
General Petraeus, you have instructed us, you've inspired us, your address was really terrific, and your answers to the questions were right on the mark. We can see that you're a commander that knows what you're doing, you have control, you're on top of things, and it's impressive and inspirational. So thank you very much for being
thank
here.
You, sir. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And now we always wind up these events with a little music. So let's have the music.